Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, good evening. I'm L.A. Steele. And tonight, we're going to discuss mysticism. Mysticism has always been fascinating to me. It's always been a serious study. And I'm not really sure if I can understand, if I can explain why exactly it is, but over the last many, many years of my life, I'm not that young, I've had many unexplainable experiences that I was always fascinated, even as a child, by mystics, the idea of mystics, and how they saw things and how they felt things and how they inspired generations, thousands and thousands of years of great inspiration. I'm going to read a generic explanation of it tonight, but from a personal standpoint, I've always believed that everybody has the ability to be a mystic, essentially. Everybody has, just being human, creates within us that we're created with that ability to connect to God, connect to the universe, connect to that universal knowledge, that universal power that flows. It actually flows within us. We are spirit. In fact, there's a very famous saying that says we are spirits having a human experience, not humans having a spiritual experience. We're actually spirits. And I've come to that belief over the years that that's more or less true. I say more so. And that those who are intuitive, those who have intuitive abilities, tap into that. They're tapped into that universal consciousness and in different ways. It gives them great insights. It gives them protection. It gives them a knowledge that other people don't have. It is difficult to say. A compassion, a sense of universality, or a universal consciousness, if you will. And it creates within you an ever-growing hunger for spiritual knowledge, for that cosmic knowledge, to open these doors and seek these answers and to these great mysteries. And because of that, I've always taken mysticism. Many people laugh at it, and many people scoff at those who, are of a higher consciousness. And I've always felt pity for them, not knowing that incredible sense of oneness with the universe that I've had over many years and have been able to connect to. Sometimes I don't. I mean, sometimes we all lose it. But when we meditate, when we pray, or when we, in prayer is meditation, essentially, we become in tune with that universal power. And we find that it is so overwhelming and so forgiving and so magnificent that once you've touched it, or once it's touched you, you never forget it. And it's kind of like an addiction to want to continue to have that state of mind or be in that state of mind. It's like the great story of Buddha, who just sat and for months just sat there in that mystical state and didn't move. And the odd thing was, his body didn't deteriorate. His nothing happened other than he reached that perfect state of nirvana. we all can, and we all are able to achieve that level, provided that we can focus on the purest I'm reluctant to say love, but the purest focus of and essentially channeling that incredible power. It's not something that will make you rule the world, or not something that will make you any more. May not even bring you any more wisdom than you already have. All it does, essentially, is connect you to that divine element, that cosmic consciousness. And once you have that, you'll never be the same. Once you've connected to that, once you've found that door, it opens that door to that world, that you'll never be the same. Even though you try, and you try to relate to this reality, it doesn't work that way, you know, because what happens is that once you've connected to that, you suddenly become aware of other people's suffering. You become aware of evil in the world. You become aware of the principalities at work who are trying to destroy mankind, and trying to destroy our mind and our connection to the universe. Because once they do that, they understand that they control us. Once they cut off our connection to this, to the heavens, or to God, then we no longer, they have us in control. They can manipulate us in any way that they want to. But once you had that experience, you will never say you will never have, you'll never feel the same way about your life and about the life of others, about the world in general, and you'll become kind of a warrior, if you will, a warrior. And I say that in the in the highest sense, like Christ was a warrior, Buddha, they were warriors. Saint Francis, a warrior. These were men of tremendous, tremendous spiritual strength and integrity that stood up to forces of evil and did good in the world and brought messages to they were prophets and mystics, and their writings to this day and their words are still remarkable. But what most of them did was love and compassion that they preached. But at the same time, if you study these men, they were tremendously they were tremendously contradictive. They had their own habits. They had their own things that they fought. Their own weaknesses. Their own problems and adversity. But yet they found, through their connection to the universe and to God, And I have to say this because I'm biased in the sense that there is one God. I strongly believe that. Not that he's Catholic or Protestant or Buddhist or Muslim or Jewish. He's one God. And he's a man that confuses the message. And mysticism has been achieved in all these religions from men of great faith and men of great compassion and learning. And they've all led to the same basic place, which is to, in the same basic wisdoms that they've been given and messages that they've presented to their followers and to the world. And I'm going to do that right now. I want to go to this. This is an interesting website that I've found. It's called Mystico, The Mystico, and Mystica, and it's an online encyclopedia of the occult, mysticism, magic, paranormal, and more. And I'm going to read the generic explanation. I think it's rather good, but it gives a good understanding of an explanation of what mysticism is throughout the ages. Now it's been connected to the religions and to men and women who have experienced it. And I'll begin the reading. Mysticism. This is a belief in or the pursuit in the unification with the One or some other principle, the immediate consciousness of God, or the direct experience of religious truth. Mysticism is nearly universal and unites most religions in the quest for divinity. It can also be a sense of mystical knowledge. Dionysus, the Arian Pagan, was the first to introduce the concept unknown knowing to the Western world. In areas of the occult and psychic, it denotes an additional domain of esoteric knowledge and paranormal communication. Even though it is thought that just monks and ascetics can become mystics, mysticism usually touches all people at least once in their lives. And that's what I was trying to explain to you earlier. The term mysticism comes from the classical Greco-Roman mystery cults. Perhaps it came from Mayan, or M-Y-E-I-N, meaning to close the lips and eyes, and refers to the sacred oath of initiates, the mists who to keep a secret about the inner workings of the religion. The Neoplatonism mysticism came to be associated with secrecy of any kind. A term mystica appears in the Christian treatise Mystica Theologia of an anonymous Sien Neoplatonist monk of the late 5th or 6th century, who was known pseudonymously as Dionysus the Areopagite. In this work, mysticism was described as a secrecy of the mind. And that's a fascinating thought, secrecy. We all keep it secret, essentially, because the world is too harsh. The world is too skeptical to explain this all at one time to anybody. And it's always been, even Christ stated, that for those who seek, they will find. And knock on the door and it'll open. So basically, if you are of the like mind and you're seeking that truth that mysticism brings to you, then you will seek it and you will find it. Okay. The term mystica appeared in the Christian treatise Mystica Theologia of an anonymous Sien Neapolitan monk of the late 5th century, which I already stated. Despite the various approaches to mysticism, it seems to possess some common characteristics. Such were the findings of the philosopher W.T. Stace, who discovered seven common themes of mysticism when studying Roman Catholic, Protestant, ancient, classical, Hindu, and American agnostic mystical experiences. They were a unifying vision and perception of the One by the senses and through many objects. 2, the apprehension of the One as an inner self or inner life, and the objective and true sense of reality. Feelings of satisfaction, joy, and bliss. 5, the religious element, that is a feeling of the holy and the sacred. The paradoxical feeling. And 7, an inexpressible feelings. Inexpressible feelings. And that's so true. That's why you can't really. Mystics are a very private people. They're a very unique group of individuals. And there are many, many, many mystics. And those, the famous ones, are teach and so on. But there are others who do not. Who feel so intense in their connection to God that it's an inexpressible feeling. You can't describe it. From the above can easily be seen that mysticism is not the same to every person experiencing it. Therefore, there are various kinds of types. Various mystics subscribe to one or two theories of divine reality, emanation or immanence. In the emanation view, all things in the universe are overflowing from God. In the immanence view, the universe is not projected from God, but is immersed in God. Mysticism is usually thought of as being of a religious nature, which can be either monistic or theistic. And the objective of monistic mysticism is to seek unity and identity with a universal principle, while theistic mysticism seeks unity, but not identity with God. So that's rather fascinating because I'll go on. The ultimate expression of monistic mysticism is perhaps best displayed by the Upanishads of India, as in the concepts of I am Brahman, the all-pervading principle, and Tat Ram Ast, that thou art, meaning that the soul is the eternal and absolute being. Monistic mysticism is also found in Taoism, and which seeks unity with Tao, or Tao, T-A-O, but it's pronounced Tao, and the ineffable way. Theistic mysticism, unity with God, characterizes Christianity, Judaism, in the Kabbalah, and Islam, the Sufi sect, and is also found in Hinduism. There are other forms of mysticism throughout the world. Many assume a religious nature according to the beliefs and practices of the practitioners. Most of these states of mysticism commonly possess what is deemed a mystical communion with what is considered sacred, which varies from group to group, even subgroup to subgroup, and includes dance, song, and chant, sacred pipe, purifying sweats, preliminary for undertakings, fast, dreams, vision quests, and the occasional use of psychotropic drugs. Apart from religious mysticism, but not entirely separated from it, is non-religious mysticism. This is more of an experiencing mysticism through or from nature, although some have discovered God or the absolute of nature through such experiences. An authentic experience of mysticism derived from nature is essentially the unity of the subject and the object. In other words, the person becomes one with nature. All boundaries or separations between the person and nature disappear, and the person becomes part of nature and is not separate from it. And that is incredible, but the problem today is that Nature is being destroyed around us. We are destroying, consciously destroying it as we cultivate it and commercialize it and cut it down and blow it up and it's just beyond imagination. And people, even 20, people 100 years ago, could never believe that what we're doing in the 21st century, to our environment. And we're molesting our environment, just as we're molesting ourselves. I mean, we're destroying us. We're destroying our planet. And by destroying our planet, we destroy our connection, our most basic connection to nature and to this third dimension that we exist in. And because of that, we're separate from it. I have to go back to my favorite, one of my favorite writers, Emerson, who was purely connected to nature. He walked every day in the woods in his farm, and he got so much, he connected to God and to the universe that he could write these remarkable essays and understand these tremendous universal laws and write things like the Oversoul and the laws of compensation and the just so many circles and so on. There's so many essays that he was able to comprehend the magnitude of infinity by his relationship to nature. In fact, his first essays were entitled Nature. And person becomes part of nature and is not separate from it. This is clearly seen in the goddess religions, which include neo-paganism and neo-pagan witchcraft, which worships nature. Such worship includes love, where the separation between the subject and object vanishes. Starhawk in the Spiral Dance defines it as immanence. Immanence is one of the three core principles of the goddess religion, the other two being interconnections and community. Immanence means that the gods are embodied, that we are each a manifestation of the living being of the earth, that nature, culture, and life, and all their diversity are sacred. Immanence calls us to live our spirituality here in the world, and to take action to preserve the life of the planet, and to live with integrity and responsibility. And there's nothing wrong with that concept, all right? None whatsoever. And that's what we're violating. We're violating, and just as we violate women, just as we violate children, as we violate ourselves as men, I'm speaking from a standpoint of men, but this is what's happening to us, and we're losing our connection to nature and to the universe through that. Here's an example of why do we feel exhilarated on a beautiful blue day, sunny day, where things are green and life around us is birds are singing and trees are blooming and flowers are blooming and everything is just coming together now in the spring, for instance, where, we feel that life generating within us and that energy coming to us, and that's the energy of the universe, that's the energy of life, the energy of nature, and the mother of all. And we're destroying that. We are destroying that in this modern day. And it's a frightening thing, a frightening, horrible loss that we're experiencing. And callously doing so with wars, with pollution, with chemtrailing, with everything that's going on now. Is everything is genetically modified foods and pesticides and everything that's destroying our planet and ourselves. Man once had the capability of living as Methuselah. Early man lived many, many, many years longer, hundreds of years. It wasn't uncommon to live 500, 600, 700, and 800 years. Biblical characters are full of that longevity. Until we come to modern man, and modern man meaning in the last 2,000 years probably or more, war and death and destruction became the way of life, the way of our lives, and we lost that connection to Mother Earth. Instead, we became greedy. We found the greed and possession and ownership and wealth all became part of the human existence that was not as predominant prior to the last 3,000 or 4,000 years. In as much as people that lived in communities and understood more, had a more of a universal consciousness and sharing and relating, and it wasn't until the beginning of the merchant classes that we found that these things became the acquisition of money became God rather than nature, and they found that by destroying nature, we could create wealth. This artificial wealth, gold and silver and paper currency, and that this replaced our ability to create that ourselves without money, without currency. These things were available to us, and people shared their wealth with their community. They shared their good fortune. They wanted their communities to thrive. You had great leaders and great chieftains and so on that took that had great compassion for their for the land and for their people. And great responsibility there. But that's all been destroyed over the many, many years because of greed and power, and that's corrupted the minds of men. And thus, the connection to God has been diminished and dimmed to the point that in so many people, it's not even there. This is why you have mass suicides. You have deprivation and despair and evil in so many places has taken over because people can't see the light anymore. Their connection to nature has just diminished. So now they have to take that further step if they want to reach God, and that further connection is through prayer, through meditation, and through knowledge, the acquisition of knowledge and understanding. The world community and the world religions, and to understand that oneness, Christ was not nature, Buddha was not nature, none of these were nature, before we had that immediate connection to nature, and we still do, to those who are open to it. Nature nurtures us, regardless of how bad we are to it. And it's like a mother who continually loves us regardless of how bad we are or how messed up we are or how much we hurt them. And that's what we're doing to nature. But nature continues to love us. But nature will become mad. It gets mad. It gets angry. And the more we... And the one thing that governs nature is balance and harmony. Balance is nature's law. And if things become unbalanced in its nature, then it takes great upheavals and whatnot to correct those imbalances. And you're seeing that today. Let's go on. A similar point was made in the description of Gaia, which was the Mother Earth, or Mother, previously called Terabee, or the planet Earth, by Otter Sell, formerly Tim Sell, founder and high priest of the Church of All Worlds in Ukiah, California. He redefined divinity and deity as the fulfillment of potential, as the highest level of awareness, consciousness, aware consciousness, accessible to each living being, manifesting itself in the self-actualization of that being. So the cell is thought of as God by its components. The tissue is God to the cells, and so on. The human being manifests a whole new level of awareness, organization, and emergent wholeness. When describing this level of organization, Zell wrote, we find it appropriate to express recognition of this unity in the phrase, thou art God. And as all things are connected biologically, all ecosystems express a new level of awareness. Therefore, Mother Earth is seen as God of this, Zell wrote. Indeed, even though yet unawakened, the embryonic slumbering subconscious mind of Terabrea is experienced intuitively by us all and has been referred to instinctively by us as Mother Earth, Mother Nature, the Goddess, and the Lady. Instinctively, everyone has done what the neo-pagan openly admit doing, calling Earth Mother. This recognition of Earth as our Mother is justified because we all are dependent on her for our survival. Just as the child comes to love the mother who cares and nurtures him, so do we love Mother Earth, for who we know loves and nurtures humankind and her children. By definition, this is mysticism. And I'm going to continue here in a second. I'm going to go to... I want to go. But that's a basic explanation of it. Now we can go into past and present beliefs, and there's tons of things that... I think it's much easier. Let's talk about... I think we should talk about the Akashic Records. That's a very significant thing to talk about, especially in mysticism, because what it is the... and then we'll talk about the altered states of consciousness. If we have enough time, I think we will. Let me explain what the Akashic Record is. A theosophical term referring to a universal filing system which records every occurring thought, word, and action. The records are impressed on a subtle substance called akasha, or a cenophorous ether. In Hindu mysticism, this akasha is thought to be the primary principle of nature from which the other four natural principles, fire, air, earth, and water, are created. These five principles represent the five senses of the human being. Since some indicate the Akashic Records as similar to a cosmic or collective consciousness, the records have been referred to by different names, including the cosmic mind, the universal mind, the collective unconsciousness, or the collective subconscious. Others think the Akashic Record may make clairvoyance and psychic perception possible. It is believed by some that the events recorded upon the Akasha can be ascertained or read in certain states of consciousness. Such states of consciousness can be induced by certain stages of sleep, weakness, illness, drugs, and meditation. So not only mystics, but ordinary people can and do perceive the Akashic records. Some mystics claim to be able to reanimate their contents, like they were turning on a celestial television set. Yogis often believe that these records can be perceived in certain psychic states. I have a tendency to believe that because some of my earliest mystical experiences were in dream states where I saw things, where I saw information that I never saw before, where I was actually reading in my sleep, taking in information that I never have. I didn't know where it was coming from or how, and that I woke up and I retained it all. And these are the fascinating things, and they led to greater and greater and greater awareness of the of our ability to tap into the the Akashic record, but more so the universal mind that stores everything. It's like I hate to compare it to a large computer because it's far, far greater than that. It not only does it record the intellectual, but also the emotional aspects of man. Everything that we think and do in our lives are recorded in the Akashic record. And we're kind of like a computer that turns off at night. When we sleep, we are downloading that information into from our subconscious, downloading it into the Akashic record, which is attainable to everybody, all right, as well. It's not that we're losing it. But if we're open to it, it's like having an infinite capacity, like a gigabytes or terabytes or whatever. It's like having an infinite capacity to store information, and it's stored in the universal mind, in that Akashic record. And that's where so much of our religion has come up with. Well, when you go to heaven, you're going to be they're looking at everything that you're doing and evaluating your life and whether you're going to be, go to heaven or go to hell or whatever. I mean, that's where essentially that whole thing comes from. It comes from the concept of the Akashic record, which is the universal mind, which knows everything. Even Santa Claus, he knows when you were sleeping. He knows when you were bad. He knows, that whole thing is a play on the ancient and I shouldn't say, and I should say not only ancient, but infinitely ancient knowledge that there is a day or there is a judgment or a record of our existence. Even though we feel we're totally insignificant in this world, there is a God who watches over us, and we can tap into that power whenever we please, whenever we ask for it. It'll come to us. We may forget it, and we may ignore it, and we may curse it, and we may say it's not there, and it's not, that's foolish. But it isn't. It's there. I know it's there because I've tapped into it continually. I constantly tap into it, and anybody can, as long as they're open to the idea that it exists. It is believed by some that events recorded upon the Akasha can be ascertained or read in certain states of consciousness. I just read that. But such states of consciousness can be induced by certain stages of sleep, weakness, illness, and so on. Some mystics claim to be able to reanimate their contents like they were turning on a celestial television set. Yogis also believe that these records can be perceived in certain psychic states. Certain persons in subconscious states do read the Akashic records. An explanation for this phenomena is that the Akashic records are the microcosm of the individual subconscious mind. both function similarly, and they possess thoughts which are never forgotten. The collective subconscious gathers all thoughts from each subconscious mind, which can be read by other subconscious minds. An example of one whom many claim successfully read the Akashic Records is the late American mystic Edgar Cayce. Cayce did his reading in a sleep state or trance. Cayce's method was described by Dr. Wesley H. Ketchum, who for several years used Cayce as an adjunct to his medical practice. Cayce's subconscious is in direct communication with all other subconscious minds and is capable of interpreting through his objective mind and imparting impressions received to other objective minds, gathering in this way all knowledge possessed by endless millions of other subconscious minds. Apparently, Cayce was interpreting the collective subconscious mind long before the psychiatrist C.J. Jung postulated this concept of the collective unconscious. And so that is, to me, extremely important in the sense that it is it exists. We know it exists. And that everything that we do, I mean, think of it in this way. Think of it in this sense: our feeble minds, our simple minds, can remember things. Remember our entire life. We remember stuff back to, you know, early childhood, okay, things that happened to us. And those things are a play upon our psyche throughout our entire lives. Until we're extremely old, we don't forget these traumas, or we don't forget this wisdom or these teachings by our parents or our grandparents or by teachers or by certain people that have inspired us or have taught us truths that we know exist and we've used and, you know, have helped us survive and throughout our lives. So why is it so hard to believe that there is a grand divine consciousness that just knows everything, and we can tap upon that? And we do, in every insight and every inspiration that we have is a tapping into that subconscious, but yet universal mind, okay, and in the Akashic Record as well. Altered states of consciousness. Altered states of consciousness generally include alterations in both the content and functioning of the consciousness, usually experienced by an individual and observed by others watching him. The term state is not to be trivialized, but denotes the state of stages of behavior through which the individual progresses. Frequently, persons in these states appear to be in a sleep-like condition, commonly referred to as a trance. Among the long-term effects are the radical shifts in the perceptions in oneself and environment that result in a semi-permanent redefinition of oneself, world, and values. I had mentioned this earlier before, that is what exactly happened to me. Frequently altered states of consciousness either are induced personally or by others, which may or may not produce lasting effects. Some religious groups do seek to induce such altered states in person, so they may derive spiritual insight and value changes from them. The most dramatic example of these states are mystical experiences. When used in occult and mysticism term, trance usually denotes an altered state of consciousness. A supreme example of a trance-like state is in occultism, particularly in neo-pagan witchcraft, is witnessed in the ceremony of the drawing down the moon. In an altered state of consciousness, the high priestess assumes the spirit of the goddess. Within this state, energy, which is believed to be the power of the goddess, is raised. Often it is believed that the goddess inspiringly speaks through the high priestess. A similar ceremony called drawing down the sun, or drawing down the horned god. The horned god is similarly invoked in the same manner as described in the drawing down the moon. The high priest enters a state of altered consciousness in which he assumes the spirit of the horned god. In mysticism, the altered state of consciousness may be total or partial. When partial, the state of consciousness is usually only a feeling. Most generally, this feeling is one of unity with God or the universe or of enlightenment. Most mystics do not believe in the transcendence, immanence of God. They generally subscribe to one of two theories concerning divine reality, emanation or immanence. From the emanation viewpoint, the universe and everything in it is an outflowing from God. While the immanence view holds that the universe is not a projection from God, but rather it is immersed in God. And I have a tendency as I get older and become more feeling of this, I'm beginning to believe in the immersed aspect of God. The immanence of God, being all of us, all part of what we are. And it's those that deny that God-like attribute of man, or that God is in man, that we cut that part out and we deny that, then what we're doing is denying our own true existence, denying what we are. And this is why I said earlier in the show that I believe that we work, we're spirit having a human experience, right? And we're not a human having a spiritual experience. And they generally subscribe to one of two theories concerning divine reality. Again, emanation or immanence. The experience of being united with God or nature is called a mystical experience. Such experience may be of a religious or non-religious nature. The non-religious experience derives much of their content from nature, although many religious mystics have been led to God or the Absolute through nature. And that's very, very true. However, not all transcendental experiences with nature are mystical, but just render feelings of overwhelming joy or ecstasy. Now again, they stated the transcendental aspect, their transcendental experiences. Emerson was a transcendentalist. He believed in the closeness and oneness with nature, and that God was in all men, and that good was in all men. It just had to be brought out. It had to be instructed. They had to understand it, you know. And, but, again, he was a great, great teacher. However, not all transcendental experiences with nature are mystical, but just render feelings of overwhelming joy or ecstasy. Causes other than religious beliefs, such as illnesses and accidents, can result in altered states of consciousness or mystical experiences. In 1971, John, a graphic designer in his late 30s, smashed his legs in a motorcycle accident. When I regained consciousness, he said, I looked at a tree in a certain way. He became a pagan. Developed a language with trees. This was a sort of divinatory system. And he found a druidic order, which now has 150 members by subscription, a journal with a circulation of 750, and an inner group. The accident could have caused a mystical experience because great pain can release a neurochemical response. At least it seemed to seem so to this person, who emphatically states the formation of his order is the direct result of the accident. I can believe that. I can seriously believe that, since my experience was great, great pain, where I had an industrial accident when I was like 17, and it cut off part of my hand, my thumb. It went back together again, but I've been impaired since then, and slightly, it's not noticeable anymore, but you know, it's still an impairment. I lost about 25% of the function of my left hand. But the intensity of pain involved with the hand, especially the hand being one of the hand and feet are the two most sensitive parts, and the genitalia as well. But the nerve endings are in your hands and your feet. So any violation of those areas, okay, through a wound or crushing or cutting or whatever, it causes excruciating pain and intensity of which I've never experienced since, and hope never to. But at that moment, in the moment of my greatest pain, I remember lying in a hospital bed, and I remember the pain in my hand being right after my surgery, the same night of the accident. I was in a hospital bed with my hand in a huge cast, and had taken, I think it was like over 120 or 30 stitches to sew it back. But the pain was so intense, and I was getting hourly injections of morphine. But between the morphine and the pain inducement, I went into an altered state, one that I can't really describe perfectly, but maybe not fully accurately, because it was emotional as well as visual. But I saw I was able to see a light. I saw a bright white light, even though my eyes were closed, and I was, you know, I couldn't sleep, but my eyes were closed because the pain was so great. But I saw this tremendous. It started off more as a thin light, but I followed that light, and it seemed to become greater and greater and larger and larger and larger until my whole, even though my eyes were closed, my whole mind became light. And though the pain was still there, it subsided in the sense that I went into that light. It was almost as an out-of-body experience, and it relieved the pain. It relieved the pain, though I could still feel it. I could endure it, but only because it was the light. I was in the light. I felt this great warmth and this great love and this great compassion and this great sorrow and this great whatever. All of these emotions played into it. And it was at that moment that I believed I possibly saw God, or at least, if not God, the universal mother or the one. And whether it was in me or out of me, I do not know to this day. But it changed my life into the sense that it gave me patience, some patience. It gave me faith and belief that there was something much greater that was out there that was guiding my life, basically. And I never felt, after that, I never felt the sense of mortality as much as I did before. Even though I was a young teenager and experienced something very traumatic, I never again felt alone. Like, I could always connect after that to that light. And it became a friend. It became a comfort that to this day is still there. And that's why I'm talking about this tonight. And in the few minutes that I have left, I wanted to just end this briefly. The experience of being united with God or nature is called mystical experience. Such experiences may be of religious or non-religious nature. The non-religious experience derive much of their content from nature, although many religious mystics have been led to God or the Absolute through nature. I just read this, but however, not all transcendental experiences with nature are mystical, but just render feelings of overwhelming joy or ecstasy. Causes other than religious beliefs, such as illnesses and accidents, can result in altered states of consciousness or mystical experiences, which is what I had. And in 1971, John, a graphic designer, I explained that too. Emanuel Swedenborg, 1688-1772, the Swedish scientist and scholar, also claimed to have experienced mystical experiences in the form of dreams. These episodes began at the age of 56, and in these dreams, he traveled to spiritual planes such as heaven and hell, where he claimed to have spoken with Jesus and God and spirits of the dead, which he referred to as angels. Also, he claimed to have seen the order of the universe. He continued spending most of the remainder of his life taking these spiritual journeys, usually in light sleep or trance, which sometimes lasted as long as 3 days. As a result of these trips, his spiritual views differed greatly from Orthodox Christianity. His views were published in several books, and I've read some of his works on the show. There's, if you go back into our archives, I've read a number of his works. Swedenborg's techniques of achieving the state of altered consciousness or trance were induced into spiritualism. One individual that actively participated in this introduction was Andrew Jackson Davis, an American and a student of Swedenborg. He is said to have paved the way for mesmerism to spiritualism. Spiritualism had large followings in the United Kingdom and the United States because of many churches. It had no legal status before 1951, when the final Witchcraft Act of 1735 was repealed. And under that act, it was possible for a medium to be charged with witchcraft. Edgar Casey, who lived from 1877 to 1945, sometimes called the sleeping prophet, gave prophetic healing and karmic readings in light sleep state, similar to that of Swedenborg. Casey put himself into hypnotic trance while lying down and then gave personal readings. He helped heal many persons this way by describing their ailments and then prescribing what the person should do in the form of treatment. He gave many karmic readings telling about the lost continent of Atlantis and other ancient places. Frequently, when giving solitary readings, Casey would have the person taking down his reading tap him to prevent him from going into a deeper sleep. Also, within shamanism, altered states of consciousness are employed, and I've studied shamanism as well, and that they are often self-induced by the shaman and called the shamanic state of consciousness. This state can vary from a light sleep to a coma, which enables the shaman to see and do things in a non-ordinary reality, which he cannot do in the ordinary reality of a waking state. It is in this non-ordinary reality the shaman can perform cures which help with the help of the guardian spirits, the spirit helpers, and do shape-shifting or metamorphosis. And various societies and groups have and do use hallucinogenic drugs to induce altered states of consciousness. Such drugs can be dangerous and cause long-term effects. I've never had to use those in order to reach that altered state because once you've been there without drugs, you really don't have to use them to go back there. And if you can do anything without resorting to psychedelic or psychotropic drugs, my suggestion is to do it that way, do it without drugs. And it can be done. It can be done much more easily and much more safely by simply connecting to nature, connecting to God, connecting. It is as simple as having flowers in your house, or just looking at the incredible beauty and complexity, and at the same time simplicity of a flower or a plant. And with that, we're going to end tonight. Time is up, and I hope everybody got something out of it. And please go to Mystica, the Mystica, which is, and you can read more on this topic. And you can join it. Also, please join us tomorrow night when we have George Dixon with us, as we enter into more of this type of talk, and but more into the paranormal, and possibly the what's happening. I'd like to continue possibly tomorrow with George, and we'll talk about the sixth night of the Mayan calendar, or that's the description of it, but it's the time that we're in right now when all great, it's the time of the apocalypse, basically. But the apocalypse, remember, isn't the great war and devastation. What apocalypse means in Greek is the unveiling, the great unveiling. And that's what the apocalypse means. And it's a time of the great unveiling, which is also predicted in the sixth night of the Mayan calendar. The Mayans predicted this time as the apocalyptic time, meaning the unveiling of the fourth dimension, the unveiling of all the falseness in our society, and the falseness everywhere, but also the unveiling of great spirits, the unveiling of everything will be unveiled, and we will see, and the human beings will see and understand in the next few years, by 2012. That unveiling is now taking place, and again, the apocalypse means just that, the unveiling. It doesn't mean great death and destruction or mayhem, not necessarily. It just means that many, 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 many people around the world will begin to see as all of the darkness, all of the evil, and all of the spells and the dark magic and everything will be revealed to us, and the plans of evil ones, and the world domination, and the projects to destroy mankind. All of these will be revealed to us, and are being revealed now, and as we rise to a higher consciousness, and which is what that means. So, with that thought, I will leave you tonight, and thank you for listening, and join us tomorrow night with Lila and George Dixon.